Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's first press conference today, at which he lambasted the Republicans for their blatant nationwide voter suppression push, which he described as, it's sick, mentioning a bill just passed today by Georgia Republicans that would make it a misdemeanor crime to give food and water to voters waiting in long lines. Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and host of the podcast Another Way and author of They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy, joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Post, This Is No Time to Compromise on Democracy. We will discuss Biden's apparent determination to get H.R. 1 and S.B. 1 passed in spite of what he describes as massive un-American Republican voter suppression, which, quote, I'm convinced that we'll be able to stop this because it is the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic what they're trying to do, and it cannot be sustained. Then we'll look into the ambitious infrastructure program Biden outlined today with new, better-paying jobs in the future that will allow Americans to benefit from U.S. innovation instead of the Chinese, that will also address global warming, like capping the thousands of wells spewing methane, about the worst global warming gas imaginable. Robert Hockett, professor of law and a professor of public policy at Cornell University and a regular contributor to Forbes magazine, where he has an article, Building Back Better Phase 2, Time Now to Jumpstart Domestic Production, joins us to anticipate Republicans bringing up Solyndra as an example of bad public investment, when a little firm named Tesla also got money from the same Obama program, and now it is the most heavily capitalized firm in the world. Then finally, with Biden revealing today how he and China Xi Jinping have had many long conversations and know where each other stands in the struggle between democracy and autocracy, we will speak with Trevor Sutton, a senior fellow for national security and international policy at the Center for American Progress. He joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Great Power Competition is Not Enough. The United States needs to show it can make a cleaner world than China's. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School and the host of the podcast Another Way and the founder of EqualCitizens.us and the co-founder of the Creative Commons. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. And his books include Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic, and They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And he has an article at the Washington Post, This Is No Time to Compromise on Democracy Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Lessig.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And at the press conference today, Joe Biden's first press conference, it didn't look like he in any way wants to compromise on reforms, and particularly H.R. 1 or S.B. 1. He said what the Republicans are doing. In fact, he was asked about, is he worried that the Democrats could lose the House and Senate in 2022 in the midterm elections? And he said, quoting him, what I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick. But then he went on to say, I'm convinced that we're able to stop this because it's the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic what we're trying to do, and it cannot be sustained. And of course, we're talking about Republican voter suppression. So What was your impression of those fighting words from President Biden?
Incredibly encouraging. You know, I mean, I've been in this fight for almost 15 years. And certainly 15 years ago, I would never have imagined we would be here with the most ambitious democracy reform package that has passed the House now twice since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And with a real commitment in the Senate to get it passed as it is, and obviously an agreement by the president to sign it. And it is existential to the majoritarian democracy that we have. I think people are missing this fact. You know, what the Republicans are talking about doing in, you know, 240 bills that have been introduced across the country and with the redistricting because of reapportionment in the 2020 census is to embed a minority government in our majoritarian democracy. You know, this is like Syria or Iraq or Rwanda, but it's not an ethnic group, it's a partisan group, because they've got the capacity to bend the rules to make it so the party with the most votes doesn't win. Now, you know, in other countries, the court would step in and say, hey, wait a minute, you can't take a majoritarian democracy and make it minoritarian. That's just against the idea of a representative democracy. But our Supreme Court has completely backed away from any intent to constrain what these state legislatures have done. And indeed, the only time they've intervened has been to double down on the power of the minority through money and speech to exert disproportionate influence over the political process. So this is existential, not just to the Democratic Party, but to the idea of a majority democracy. And I think we've got to really rally people to make sure that the Senate actually passes this bill.
And indeed, if we needed more evidence of the mendacity of the Republicans, today, Thursday, the Georgia Republican-led State House of Representatives passed a law, among other things, that would make it a misdemeanor to give food or drinks to voters waiting in long lines, something that Biden actually mentioned as well, by the way. So the one thing that I thought was interesting about what Biden said, though, was he made a distinction between the professional Republicans in Congress, the Senate, and in the state houses, and Republican voters. Do you think that's a wedge that Biden could drive this reform package through?
Absolutely. You know, when I've spent many, many years out talking to, you know, regular voters about these issues, regular citizens about these issues. And outside of Washington or outside of, you know, the political, professional political classes, there's not a deep disagreement about how politics is supposed to work. You know, if you say to the average Republican voter, should we have a system where the party in power has the ability to rig the system against their competitor? Nobody would say yes to that. Yet that's exactly what's happening. The Republicans in the states have realized that when more people have an equal freedom to vote, it's harder for them to win. So they're making it harder for a particular class of people to vote. Now, you know, in places like Georgia, that looks like a racial determination. And maybe, I'm sure in part it is, but the more general fact is, it is a political justification. It's the decision of the Republican Party to use their power over state rulemaking to suppress the capacity of Democrats to win, not because they Democrats are not competitive, but because Republicans know they are not competitive. And the idea that this is happening in the open, in some sense, is astonishing. Yet, you know, we have such a polarized political environment that it's very hard for dissenting voices inside, really, of either party to have much effect. So the mainline Republican leadership from Mitch McConnell down have determined that these are the suppression techniques necessary to make it possible for the Republicans to have a shot at winning. And indeed, I think if they implement what they're talking about in 2022, we will move from a precariously majoritarian democracy to a predictably minoritarian democracy. And I don't know what we do, given there's no alternative in the courts to resist that.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Lessig, Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School and the host of the podcast Another Way and founder of EqualCitizens.us and co-founder of Creative Commons. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. And his books include Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic, and They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And he has an article at the Washington Post, This Is No Time to Compromise on Democracy Reform. Well, when you say that's a minoritarian direction, it's also an authoritarian direction, and certainly not majoritarian. And I think one of the people who's driving it, of course, is pretty obvious that it is Donald Trump in terms of his Stop the Steal lies that have led, at least at the very least, they've given people like Mitch McConnell the cover to suggest that there's a problem that needs to be fixed, when of course there's no problem. Biden won and Trump lost, and even his own judges that he appointed found that to be the case. So how much do you attribute this to, and of course, I suppose the good news is that we don't know the extent to which Trump is actually using this Stop the Steal lie to raise money, which actually can go right into his pocket, or whether he's going to continue to be the kingmaker in the Republican Party. How do you see his role going forward, Lawrence?
Well, I'm terrified about his role. You know, there was a brief moment after the tragedy of January 6th, where it seemed to me the Republican Party had an opportunity to rid itself of Donald Trump. And it's astonishing to me that, you know, somebody like Mitch McConnell, who had stood so strongly on January 6th against the big lie, and so critical of Donald Trump for inciting that riot or insurrection, it's astonishing to me he didn't just say, look, here's the line, you crossed it, and I'm going to vote to convict. Because if Mitch McConnell had voted to convict, there's a chance that there would have been the two-thirds necessary to disqualify him from the capacity to run again, and Republicans would be openly looking at who their next kingmaker is. But right now, you know, obviously 147 members of Congress vote to affirm the big lie on January 6th. There's like a handful of them that are just stupid enough to believe it. The rest of them are doing it simply out of cowardice. They know what was said by the president is false. They know there was no fraud at a level sufficient to throw these elections into doubt. And the very best of them, you know, people like Josh Hawley or Ted Cruz, both of them, you know, superstar lawyers, know that there was no legal basis, literally no legal basis, for them to vote against the counting of those electoral votes. Yet they did it because they are terrified of the primary challenges that the Trump machine will deploy against them. And they excuse themselves by saying, well, you know, our constituents believe the election was stolen, so we've got to vote with our constituents. Now, you know, here's where Mitt Romney, I think, was just perfectly spot on brilliant. You know, if your constituents are wrong about something, you don't cave into their mistake. You explain to them that you're wrong. So if they believe this election was stolen, and I understand why they believe that, you know, when Fox News repeats more than 800 times that the election was stolen, you know, avid watchers of Fox News are going to begin to believe that that fact is true. And so I understand why people believe that, but you've got to have some courage. You've got to have some principle to stand up and say, I'm sorry, I understand you think this, but it's not true. And yet the fact that 147 didn't have that courage is terrifying. And so long as Donald Trump is able to produce that terror in the Republican Party, we won't have a serious Republican Party. We'll have this, you call it authoritarian, I think that's fair, but it's certainly it's a personality party rather than a party of ideals. Now, the benefit of it is they're behaving so extremely that it's really encouraging the Democrats to step up and say, okay, we've got to make sure that we protect our elections from the efforts to suppress the vote and to pass this S1 HR1, and I'm especially encouraged that so far, at least, the center is held in the sense that they're not dismembering S1. They're not going to cut out, parts like the campaign finance part, And I was extremely excited today to see Joe Manchin, you know, who on the one hand said he's going to support it as long as we can get bipartisan support, and I'm skeptical they'll get bipartisan support. But on the other hand, he made it clear that campaign finance reform has got to be part of this package. And that's consistent with his longstanding position that the kind of dialing for dollars of Congress is corrupting, and I think ultimately is going to be one of the most important things that this law could bring about.
And in your article at the Washington Post, Lawrence Lessig, "This Is No Time to Compromise on Democracy Reform," you make the point that the Democrats would be making a mistake to believe that going smaller would make it easier to get this thing passed. So do you feel that the momentum is in the other direction, given not just what Schumer has been saying, but also what Biden just said today in his first press conference? He seemed determined.
Absolutely. You know, I think that it's just a plain political mistake to think that going smaller is going to make it easier. And the reason for that is, you know, we have many problems with our democracy. Everybody agrees there's a problem with our democracy, but what everybody thinks the problem is slightly different. You know, if you're from a state like Iowa, you don't really think gerrymandering is much of a problem because it's not much of a problem in Iowa. They already have an independent districting commission, and it works pretty well despite being a, you know, overwhelmingly red state. But if you're from Iowa, you look at your Senate race, the second most expensive Senate race in the history of elections, and you think this is a crazy, crazy system that allows all of this outside money to come in to pick the senator from Iowa. So from Iowa, your concern is going to be money in politics. If you're from Georgia, you're going to look at the techniques for suppressing the vote, and you're going to think this is the thing that's most important. You might not think campaign finance is as important, although those two special elections there were pretty expensive races. But the point is, the thing that's most important to you might not be money. It might be the vote suppression. And so if you start carving up bits of it and you say this is just going to be a voting rights law, okay, you know, the representatives from Georgia will be really excited to get that passed. But what about the representatives from Iowa or the representatives from Michigan or the representatives from Nebraska? I mean, the point is, you've got to make it big enough to give everybody something they can stand up before their constituents and say, see, I got you democracy reform, and this is what it is. I've gotten you fair elections, and this is why. And so I think it's incredibly encouraging to see, you know, somebody like Manchin, who's obviously a very powerful senator right now, given the split of the Senate, to signal that he supports this reform and he supports every aspect of the reform, including the parts that some people have said we've got to drop, which is the public fund, changing the way that we fund congressional elections.
Well, obviously, you can't sort of name and shame the Republicans. Mitch McConnell lied blatantly about the history of the filibuster, saying there was no racial component to it. And we know people like Ted Cruz lie with alacrity. So given that you can't shame these people, back to the wedge that Biden might drive in the sense that the American people, including a lot of Republican voters, are appalled at the idea that you would want to cheat. I mean, can you imagine, you know, watching the Super Bowl, Lawrence, and somebody scores a touchdown at the last minute, and it's so blatant that the referee rules it out of bounds? You'd have a stadium full of people screaming, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, so yeah, what is it? I mean, what can you tap into? Is there a residual sense of fairness left in this country that can be mobilized and weaponized to stop this steal?
Well, you know, I think the bigger challenge we face there is we've evolved a media ecology, and I know you think about this a lot, but we've evolved a media ecology where we live in separate universes. You know, so when you ask the question, how is it that the majority of Republicans actually believe that the election was stolen? You know, the majority of Republicans believe completely false statements like, there were thousands of illegal votes cast, or, you know, any number of these statements that went into the argument of stop the steal. The answer is they believe it because they live in a world where that's what they heard over and over and over again. And so when you say Mitch McConnell lies openly, does he pay a price for that? If the people who he counts on, his base, his fraction of, you know, the Republican right, never even hears or recognizes that there's a lie. You know, when we have this world where we have perfectly segmented messaging, so both on, you know, platforms like Facebook and also in cable television, where nobody hears the other side, it's not so costly to engage in open deception or open lies, because, you know, who's going to notice on your side? And the other side, you don't need. So I think it's a real challenge when Joe Biden says, you know, we're going to rally the ordinary American people, because the question is, how do we get to them? How do you speak to them? How do you speak to them without the kind of crazy Tucker Carlson filter, which, you know, turns everything upside down? It's a through the looking glass like perspective on the claims that are being made in this context. I think the thing that Republicans, that Democrats have got to recognize is, you know, there was a game of doing politics in Washington that kind of made sense through about the speakership of Newt Gingrich. And that way of doing business was to kind of build coalitions that were basically cross-partisan coalitions. And all of us, in some sense, wish we were there. But we don't live in that world anymore. We just don't. And the reality is, we're at a stage in the maybe devolution of our democracy or the evolution of our democracy, but we're at a stage where parties need to come to power, and they need to say, here's why we want to be in power. Here's what we are going to accomplish. And then do it. Do it. And, you know, this is more like a parliamentary principle. Like, we're going to govern, and here's what we're going to do, and then just execute to get it done. And the idea that we ought to, you know, that the Democrats, you know, which Joe Manchin has said, need to make sure that it's bipartisan, I just think comes from a different era. And what we need to do is to make sure that the potential for democracy is preserved. And it's only preserved if we stop the states from implementing changes that will make it harder for Democrats to vote than for Republicans. Now, I say that, you know, I'm a Democrat. I say that, though, not because I'm a Democrat. I say that because this is supposed to be a representative democracy. And if you make it harder for one side to participate than the other, you're not going to produce a representative democracy. You're going to produce a democracy that represents the minority as the majority. And that, of course, is not democracy anymore. And so I think the urgent thing Democrats have to recognize is, you're not dealing with a normal policy disagreement. This is not like, you know, should we have a 3% growth of the defense budget or a 1% growth of the defense budget? This is, should we have democracy or not? And when it's at that stage, I think the Democrats just have to step back and say, okay, look, you guys are in crazy land, and we're not gonna allow it to happen. And so we're gonna protect our elections from this subversion. And we're gonna do that by passing this bill and passing it, even if we have to exempt it from the filibuster or abolish the filibuster or whatever other changes make it possible.
Well, Lawrence Lessig, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Lessig, who's Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. And he's the host of the podcast Another Way and the founder of EqualCitizens.us and the co-founder of Creative Commons. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals and for Justice Antonin Scalia on the United States Supreme Court. And his books include Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Our Congress and a Plan to Stop It, One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic, and They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy. And he has an article at the Washington Post, This Is No Time to Compromise on Democracy Reform. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the ambitious infrastructure Biden outlined today.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now are Robert Hockett, who has firsthand experience working with the International Monetary Fund, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and continues to consult for a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislatures and regulators. He drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy. And he is the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and a Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University and a regular contributor to Forbes magazine, where he covers finance, economics, law, and justice. And his latest articles include Building Back Better, Phase 2, Time Now to Jumpstart Domestic Production. And he's the co-author of the new book, Money from Nothing, or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, and Financing the Green New Deal, A Plan of Action and Renewal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Hey, Ian. So great to be with you again.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert. And at today's first press conference by President Biden, obviously there were lots of questions about the border and about China and about voting rights and the filibuster. But there are also questions about his infrastructure plans. And Biden made it clear that he's here to do a job and to make life better for Americans, not just people who voted for him, but just everybody. And we know that he's got through the $1.9 trillion first stimulus. He has a second $3 trillion COVID recovery stimulus bill in the works. And this seems to be his determination to get these bills passed one way or the other. And what's your sense from the press conference today? I thought it was so refreshing to have somebody that's sort of normal, competent, is not grandstanding and performing, and albeit a tacky performer who's both an idiot and an amateur. But this felt like somebody that was serious and, you know, was just going to get the job done. And I just wondered, frankly, while I was watching, and I was thinking, my God, I wish everybody in America was watching this. But unfortunately, most people aren't. People like you and me and the press watch the press conference. So what was your impression?
I was very impressed. And I have to say that Mr. Biden has been just, you know, impressing me day after day after day, ever since really, I think even before November, I think really starting this summer. And you remember, Ian, I mean, we talked about the candidates during the primary campaigns. And, you know, I was not exactly bullish on Mr. Biden. I tended to be more an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders type, and really didn't have high hopes for him. And he has just continually exceeded expectations. And this is just the latest case of this. You might have read recently, in addition to hearing today in the press conference, that he's talking about multiple trillions of dollars now, right? Initially, they were talking maybe two or three. Now there are suggestions that they might be willing to go even up to $5 trillion. And yesterday, Mr. Biden also suggested that he is willing to reexamine the filibuster with a view to possibly getting rid of that if that's what's going to sort of stand in the way. He seems really to mean business this time. He really seems to be determined to get it right. He, as part of the Obama administration, of course, is very well aware of how perilous it is not to go big enough. And indeed, that's the dominant wisdom as to why Mr. Obama fared poorly in the first midterm elections in 2010 was precisely because the sort of stimulus that was enacted to respond to the crash of 08 was just not enough. And he's not going to repeat that mistake. There's even, I even read something yesterday that he's getting increasingly excited about the idea that he's going to outdo his own former boss, so to speak, which is, of course, Mr. Obama. So he seems to have become a very ambitious fellow on behalf of what this country can do. And I'm just immensely impressed.
And of course, one of the traps that Obama fell into was he was trying to reach out to be bipartisan. And obviously, Biden was asked about his relationship with Mitch McConnell, and it's pretty clear that he's realistic. He would like things to be bipartisan, but if they're not, that doesn't mean you can't get on with it. And he castigated the Republicans for their double standard in sort of the sky is falling because we're running up these huge deficits when they gave $2 trillion to the richest Americans. And now Biden is trying to help average folks who are having a hard time. So again, I kept thinking, I wish all the American people were watching this, because then they have a better idea of who's running the country as opposed to this tawdry showman who was such a crook and a fool.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing what just basic competence and just good faith efforts to make the country better can do, right? How good this can look, especially against the backdrop or in comparison to what we had last time around. There's also just the benefit, I think, of the lessons learned during the Obama presidency. Mr. Obama, as you said, was dead set on, you know, being courtly and civil and, you know, trying to work out some kind of bipartisan agreement. But of course, the Republicans simply weren't interested in that. They never negotiated in good faith. It was never about, you know, finding compromise. It was always about making Mr. Obama look like a failure so that they could then pick up seats in the midterms. You and I have talked before about how McConnell's, you know, sort of first remark to his fellow Republican caucus members after election night in 2008 was, our task now is to make sure that Mr. Obama is a one-term president. And, you know, Mr. Biden was there. He saw that. And I think he's, you know, he's probably very much of the mode, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So he's not going to make that mistake. And similarly, Ron Klain, his chief of staff, was there, was present during the Obama years as well. And he recognized another mistake that the Obama people made, which was not to communicate frequently enough with the public about the successes. And so we all remember, you know, Solyndra as a kind of a so-called failure of the Obama years. But nobody ever talks about the fact that the same program that was funding Solyndra funded a little company called Tesla, which last I checked is now the has the highest market cap of all of the corporations in the world. That was an Obama success, but we never hear about it because the Obama administration was not good about communicating what was working. And I think Mr. Klain is pretty dead set on making sure that that mistake isn't repeated either. So the communication with the public, including today's press conference, I think is a good indicator that they're going to be, you know, much more on top of things, even than the Obama administration was, let alone the Trump administration.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hockett, who has firsthand experience working at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and continues to consult for a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislators and regulators. And he drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy. He's the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and a Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University and a regular contributor to Forbes magazine, where he covers finance, economics, law, and justice. And his latest articles there include Building Back Better, Phase 2, Time to Jumpstart Domestic Production. And he's the co-author of a new book, Money from Nothing, or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, and Financing the Green New Deal, A Plan of Action and Renewal. So let's talk about your article at Forbes on jumpstarting the domestic production. You just mentioned how the Republicans demagogued over Solyndra, but never mentioned the fact that a little firm named Tesla also got money from the same Obama program, and now it's the most heavily capitalized firm in the world. How do you proceed with a infrastructure plan with the Republicans, if you need them at all? I guess, I don't know whether you do, but they're just not going to cooperate. We know that they won't cooperate on anything.
Yeah.
And frankly, again, it's a big sales job. And how much infrastructure spending is in the $3 trillion second tranche, the so-called COVID recovery bill?
Mm-hmm. So I believe that the plan is still for this sort of phase two to be very infrastructure heavy and very industrial policy heavy, right? So it's going to be all about basically restoring the productive capacity of the country and restoring, you know, domestic supply chains, which, as you know, were all sort of outsourced and exported over to China during, you know, starting with the late Clinton years and then throughout the Obama years and the Trump years. Even though Trump made a big noise about supposedly, you know, sort of trying to rebalance things with China, it's noteworthy that not a single bit of progress was made there. Everything was deferred to what Trump was calling phase two, which never happened. Phase one was just basically nothing. So, you know, the idea of sort of bringing back domestic productive capacity to make this country a country that makes things again, as it used to be, is at the core here. And then, as you noted, the revitalizing of the nation's infrastructure. And that's going to be the great bulk of the total, whatever that total be, whether it be $3 trillion, $4 trillion, or even, as was talked about yesterday, $5 trillion. When it comes to sort of how to sell it or how to get Republicans on board, there are a couple things that are noteworthy. First is that if you ignore the Republicans in Congress to begin with and just look at Republicans out in the countryside, including mayors, city council members, governors, state legislatures and the like, the Biden plans are favored by about 59 or 60% of those Republicans. Right. So the first thing to note then is that this is a bipartisan plan, as long as we define partisan by reference to people who call themselves Republicans, not just, you know, the however many people are in Congress who call themselves Republicans. Second thing to note is that you can get a lot done through the reconciliation process, and much of the infrastructure and industrial policy stuff will count for purposes of reconciliation, meaning that a bare majority will be enough. And that means all you really got to make sure that you keep on board are Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Finally, thirdly, Joe Manchin himself just yesterday said that he's actually hoping to spend at least $4 trillion on infrastructure, provided at least that the Trump tax cuts can be repealed. Now, my guess is that most Democrats would be perfectly fine with repealing those unbelievably wrong-headed Trump tax cuts. And if they're willing to do that, then we've got Manchin and Sinema on board. And so all we need is, you know, the tie-breaking vote from Kamala Harris. But we can also, in a pinch, if we need to, we can put pressure on congressional Republicans, too, because, again, big infrastructure investment is very popular in Republican states as well. It's only with Republican Congress members who, as you know, don't fight this stuff on the merits. They just fight it because they're supposed to fight whoever the Democratic president is, even if they actually agree with what that president is wanting to do. Well, if we can put some pressure on some of those folk, they might cave. Marco Rubio supposedly cares about the nation's infrastructure. So let's hold them to it. And let's hold a few of these other Republicans from states that need the investment.
Sure. And Senator Wicker, of course, tried to take credit for the money to prop up the airline industry in the last COVID $1.5 trillion. Uh-huh. But let's just in the last couple of minutes, though, I wanted to talk to you about just going forward, because this sounds like something on the scale of FDR in its ambition. And we've already discussed that you're not going to get any cooperation from the Republicans, even though they say that this is one of the areas where you can cooperate. And you explained how you can. You don't have to necessarily deal with the professional Republicans in Washington, who are becoming more and more the Trump Party at any rate. So there's a lot you can do. Mm-hmm. What I detect is that much of these ambitious projects going forward are complementary. The one that he mentioned was capping all of these oil wells that haven't been properly capped that are spewing methane, which is the worst global warming gas imaginable. That's something that should be done tomorrow. And those, as Biden pointed out, are good paying jobs. So when do you think we'll start seeing some results?
I think we're going to see a lot of action pretty quickly, because some of the stuff that he wants to do is doable through executive order. And so, as you know, he's been signing all sorts of EOs to sort of get the ball rolling. Then the bill, right, the sort of phase two is the plan is to have this one passed by early summer. And once that happens, we're going to see massive change underway. And again, the economic growth that's going to come of this, Ian, is going to be enormous, because, you know, notwithstanding the false claims of these Fox types who think that basically, you know, kind of building back better or greenifying the economy means basically taking your hamburgers away and telling you that you're confined to barracks, this is about the industries of tomorrow, right? All of the green infrastructures and green industries are the industries of tomorrow. They're the high growth areas, the high manufacturing areas in the future. And we've invented most of the stuff that would be used here, but China is the only one actually capitalizing on it. If we actually don't want to be, you know, becoming backward relative to China, which Republicans claim to care about, well, then we should reclaim the industries of tomorrow that we invented. Those are going to be, it's going to be a massive industrial revolution that's earth friendly, the likes of which, as you said, we haven't seen since the New Deal. Even LBJ was not as ambitious as I think at this point Joe Biden is. And so the only real precedent that you can find, you have to go back as far as the New Deal itself.
Well, Robert Hockett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. It's really always a joy to be with you on here.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, who has had firsthand experience working at the International Monetary Fund and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and continues to consult for a number of U.S. federal, state, and local legislators and regulators. He drafted Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal resolution for the House of Representatives and officially advises her on economic policy. And he's the Edward Cornell Professor of Law and a Professor of Public Policy at Cornell University and a regular contributor at Forbes magazine, where among his latest articles is Building Back Better, Phase 2, Time Now to Jumpstart Domestic Production. And he's the co-author of Money from Nothing, or Why We Should Stop Worrying About Debt and Learn to Love the Federal Reserve, and Financing the Green New Deal, A Plan of Action and Renewal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Biden revealed at his press conference today how he and China's Xi Jinping have had many long conversations and know where each other stands in the struggle between democracy and autocracy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Trevor Sutton, who's a Senior Fellow for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked at the United Nations Development Program and International Organization for Migration, where he advised on anti-corruption issues. He also serves as a Presidential Management Fellow in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and was a judicial clerk at the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. And he has an article in Foreign Policy, Great Power Competition is Not Enough. The United States needs to show it can make a cleaner world than China's. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trevor Sutton.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there was quite a lot of discussion about China at President Biden's first press conference. A couple of things that were revealed, certainly I didn't know about, and that is that when Biden was the vice president under Barack Obama, he spent, as he said today, I spent hours upon hours with Xi Jinping. And he went on to say he's one of the guys like Putin who thinks that autocracy is the wave of the future and democracy can't function in an ever complex world. And then he went on to say about Xi, he doesn't have a democratic with a small d bone in his body, but he's a smart, smart guy. So what do you make of that, Trevor?
Well, I think it reflects a new dynamic in U.S.-China relations that is quite different than what you saw under President Obama and is different than what you saw under President Trump, but maybe has more continuity than many people were expecting. I think that the United States is approaching its relationship with China from a frame of great power competition, recognizing that China and the U.S. have very different visions for world order and very different visions for what value should be dominant in the international system. And I think Biden was echoing comments that his Secretary of State and National Security Advisor made at the Anchorage Summit. So I'm not surprised on some level, but it was interesting to hear him put it in such bold terms.
Well, he also said that after he was elected, and we know how long it took that to be confirmed because of Trump's truculence, but he did get a phone call from Xi Jinping congratulating him, and he said we talked for at least 2 hours. So it does seem, at least on the level of communication, and the impression I got from the press conference was that we do have an adult who's very down to earth and, you know, rolling up his sleeves and doing business, no frills, not grandstanding, not putting on a performance. In fact, it was quite the opposite. So that in itself is very comforting, and I don't know that a lot of American people watch the press conference, but if they did, I think they'd be impressed. So one of the things that he did say, apropos what you were just talking about, Trevor, is we're not looking for confrontation, although we know there will be steep, steep competition. We'll insist that China play by the international rules, fair competition, fair practices, fair trade. What are the chances of that coming into play?
Well, this is also echoing a statement by Secretary Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan that they
they don't want confrontation, they don't want conflict, but they welcome extreme competition. I think that whenever you have two powerful countries like the United States and China sort of assessing that their interests are on some level not completely compatible, you know, it's dangerous. And so it's very important to have an open line of communication to ensure there aren't crosswires and to ensure that situations don't escalate, you know, both most obviously in sort of military affairs, but also in trade as well. I mean, I think a lot of the Trump administration's trade policies surprised many, no more so than many in Beijing by the sort of the suddenness with which they occurred and their sort of, I guess, intemperance, as you alluded to earlier, their dramatic character. And so, you know, I do think that the strategy of the Biden administration is to identify where competition is desirable, and I think sort of trade and international influence is one, and then also to identify areas where there's no choice but to cooperate. I mean, the most obvious one being climate change. And so it's going to be choppy waters. I think there's no question. I think in part because the nature of the Chinese government has changed in the last 10 years, and the what drives the Chinese government to act may have much more to do with what's going on inside China than it does with any assessment of what's happening in the world. And that can lead to risky situations, no question. I think Taiwan being the clearest example.
And again, I'm speaking with Trevor Sutton, who's a senior fellow for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked at the United Nations Development Program and International Organization for Migration, where he advised on anti-corruption issues. He also serves as a Presidential Management Fellow in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and as a judicial clerk at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. And he has an article in Foreign Policy. Great power competition is not enough. The United States needs to show it can make a cleaner world than China's. So the changes that took place, you say, in the last 10 years, a lot of that's to do with Xi Jinping. And I guess to some extent, the first gift that Trump gave to Xi Jinping was canceling the TPP, which was much more a political arrangement than a trade deal, or a geopolitical arrangement than a trade deal. And he's turned back the clock in terms of repression inside China, built up the Communist Party and its primacy. How do you see the Communist Party? Because he's obviously, as your article points out, he's gone after corruption, but it's been somewhat selective. But there are a couple of the princelings, and of course, Xi Jinping is a princeling, the son of one of the revolutionary leaders. Ren Shiquan is in jail for criticizing him, and Kaijia, who is the granddaughter of one of the revolutionary leaders. She got out of the country, but she's on the hit list, if you like. She's called Xi a mafia boss. So is he a mafia boss of the 90 million members of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China?
So I would not necessarily say organized crime is the most appropriate analogy. What I think to understand what's happening inside, you know, the Chinese Communist Party today, you have to look back to the Mao era and how that ended. Mao's unquestioned control over the Chinese state for much of his tenure was highly turbulent and, you know, resulted in, towards the end of his life, the Cultural Revolution. After he passed, there was a very unstable succession for a few years that finally resolved with the ascendance of Deng Xiaoping. And there was a consensus within the elite ranks of the Communist Party that things needed to be more stable and predictable. So they came up with certain conventions that, although, you know, ultimately, you know, were not enforceable under any sense like our constitution, nonetheless governed the way, you know, China is run. And one of those is that you know in advance who's going to be the next chairman, and, you know, chairman is now also president of the country. That person only serves two terms. Leaders have a mandatory retirement age, and they're also supposed to strenuously avoid a cult of personality and not be particularly memorable. That was all to avoid the turbulence of the Mao era. Xi Jinping is the first Chinese leader to unwind that. He's the first Chinese leader that you know, is poised to serve more than two terms. He has knowingly cultivated, deliberately cultivated sort of personality, sort of cult around himself in a way that no Chinese premier has since Mao. And so that has been accompanied by an effort to consolidate complete control over the party in a way that previously there might have been different factions. There was the Shanghai faction that's associated with Hu Jintao, or I could be confusing who is who, and then there's a Youth Party faction that's associated with Jiang Zemin. But in any event, you know, Xi has succeeded in essentially coup-proofing his control over the party. And what that means is not necessarily that, you know, he's a mafia boss in the sense that he just has a degree of power that no leader has had for decades, and question whether that is a system that produces good outcomes. You know, when you have one person at the top with unquestioned authority, is he are people going to be able to push back against unsound decisions? Is he getting the right information, or is he just surrounded by yes men? So I do think that the sort of the contraction of the Chinese state to Xi Jinping himself is a risky development and probably portends for a more sort of the dangerous Chinese engagement with the world than would have been the case 10 years ago.
And of course, he's declared himself president for life. So what did you think, though, of the context that Biden provided in his first press conference, which I thought was refreshing? I mean, obviously, we don't have great ideological competition anymore between the superpowers, between capitalism and communism. We have really a competition between frail democracies and the rule of law under threat and growing autocracies and kleptocracies. And Biden really made that clear, that that is the struggle. And he even talked about how our grandchildren will be looking back wondering whether democracy won or autocracy won. So I thought that was helpful. What did you think?
I thought that it was a very constructive frame. You know, I'm clearly of the same view as the president, if it's not too sort of arrogant to say that, you know, as expressed in the foreign policy piece I wrote. You know, I think that China is clearly seeking to reshape global norms and international institutions in its favor. And a key element of that project is discrediting democracy as the sort of ideal or most desirable political system, and to elevate non-democratic systems as equally or more desirable to on the global stage. And this is something, you know, Chinese leadership and diplomats have done quite explicitly. They've said democracy is messy. They said, look at what China has delivered for its people. You know, they said, you need to fix your own problems. And, you know, they clearly think it's a potent line of attack. And on some level, you know, post-Trump, post-January 6th riot, it's not a line of attack that, you know, is completely without foundation. But you should avoid false equivalency, and you should avoid sort of thinking that the sort of frailties of the democratic world somehow put it in the same moral plane as an authoritarian system like China that affords its citizens virtually no rights and that is actively engaged in subjugation and ethnic cleansing in its, you know, Western frontier or border. So I thought it was constructive, you know, but now this is where the hard part begins. How do you prove that democracy, how do you prove China wrong? How do you put the lie to their counter accusations? And, you know, I think Biden was right to sort of emphasize that, you know, we have to strengthen our democracy at home. We have to fix its, you know, foundations. We have to show that it can work for people. And we also have to make clear the values we're fighting for abroad. I mean, so I think he stressed the right things. You know, personally, I think that, you know, showing that the democracies take corruption more seriously than autocracies is a particularly ripe area for making that distinction. You know, the president didn't reference that, but I think that would be something that his administration would be wise to emphasize.
Well, but there's no question that the Chinese brought, what, 500 million people out of poverty into the middle class. You've got Chinese, millions of Chinese, traveling around the world as tourists, and they go back to China. And in contrast, we've had, as you mentioned, the assault on the capital. But in general, we are a divided country. First of all, there's no consensus on what is true and what is real, which I don't know how you can solve any problems if you can't agree what the problem is in the first place. And we have this political division, which is going to be continually be exacerbated as long as Donald Trump runs a Republican Party and is choosing the primary candidates who are becoming more and more extreme, like the QAnon types, the next crop in 2022 will probably be even more extreme. So I don't. Biden didn't touch on this, although the point he did make, which I thought was interesting, and I wonder whether he can get some mileage out of this, he was making the point that he is more popular with Republican voters than perhaps the professional Republican politicians. And all of the mendacity that's going on, like with voter suppression, is he made it clear that that is being done by the professional Republican politicians. And a lot of rank-and-file voters that vote Republican are as disgusted by what's happening as he is. So let's start with that. You think there is a fissure between the Republican professional politicians and the voters that Biden can exploit?
So, I mean, I think Biden already did succeed in, I don't want to say exploit, but I mean, in drawing, you know, voters that were alienated by Trump to him and to a lesser extent to the Democratic Party, you know, in the 2020 election. I mean, listen, what I'll say is, you know, Biden's answer to sort of Chinese sort of, you know, accusations of U.S. democracy creaking is on some level himself. I mean, he did prevail in the election despite voter suppression efforts carried out by Republicans, despite constant misinformation being pushed by the Trump administration. And since coming into power, he has shown that he is going to deliver relief and deliver positive outcomes for everyone, I think. And I think that's an important, really important, and I'm trying to remember which columnist made this point, but it was a very astute one. I think it might have been an Atlantic columnist, that, you know, Joe Biden is not seeking to exact political retribution and reward his supporters. He is trying to provide a release to everyone, including Republicans, including people that would never vote for him. And that project, I think, more than anything, is key to sort of restoring the legitimacy of the U.S. democratic system. You know, I would say that the passage of the COVID assistance earlier this month was probably the most positive step his administration could have taken in that direction. So I do think that there's a fissure in the extent to which, like, Biden is willing to work for everyone in the way that many Republican politicians are not. They only want to work for their base.
Well, just in closing, obviously he did talk a lot about infrastructure, but do you think that the Quad that he did also mention, do you think that's going to turn into something that will be a check on China?
Personally, I actually have mixed views about the Quad. It's there was a very good piece in Foreign Affairs by a Korean expert on Korean security issues named Van Jackson, who made the argument that the Quad is actually a distraction and diverts U.S. attention away from our core security interests in East Asia, where they might not exist in the Indian Ocean. At the same time, I do think there is value in the U.S. saying, you know, hey, China, like your sort of coercion against Australia, your border skirmishes against India, you know, those have consequences. You can't do that and expect to be treated as the unquestioned, you know, hegemon in East Asia. There'll be consequences. And so I think that sort of that diplomatic coming together that the Quad entails, and the enhanced security cooperation and the sort of effort to distribute vaccines in the region, I think if nothing else, that shows that, you know, if China is going to be a bully, then other countries in the region are going to take note. Now, whether the Quad, you know, can meaningfully sort of deter Chinese aggression, I think that's a very different question. I think it's much less likely that you will see, I think a meaningful change in the sort of balance of military power as a result of the Quad. That's my guess. But time will tell. It's hard to know.
Well, Trevor Sutton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Trevor Sutton, who's a senior fellow for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. He previously worked at the United Nations Development Program and International Organization for Migration, where he advised on anti-corruption issues. And he also served as a Presidential Management Fellow in the Office of the Secretary of Defense and as a Judicial Clerk of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. And he has an article in Foreign Policy, Great Power Competition is Not Enough. The United States needs to show it can make a cleaner world than China's. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305,